Our first plenary of the afternoon will be Freya Stockson from Christ Church College here at Oxford. She will be talking quite closely with the conference theme, Thriving in Difficult Times, Camera Cuts and Careers, the Utility of History.
Thank you very much, Melody. I will try not to make you go to sleep this afternoon, though I can't promise. I seem to have been promoted from a 20-minute paper to an hour slot, which alarms me slightly. But I'll see what I can do. I should also apologise to any early modernists present for the not-so-amusing geeky pun in the title, which I stole from Alan Bradford's 1983 paper about the utility of Tacitus in early Stuart England. And I couldn't help but alliterate, because that's what we do in Oxford, so many apologies. I do usually feel when I'm here a bit like a relic from another century, just like some of your favourite Tory politicians up on the screen there. And so when I come and I talk about teaching and learning, sometimes I feel a little bit guilty and a little bit out of place. Oxford, as you know, is a very traditional sort of place. We have a very different context, we have a very different set of issues, a very different set of students compared with other HE institutions around the country and around the world. So thank you for bearing with me. A lot of what I'm going to say, I'm sure you guys are doing already, but we're not, and we probably won't be for another 30 years. So I'd quite like some feedback from you at the end on how perhaps I can build some of these approaches and ideas into my teaching, given that the wider context is not going to be very receptive. So just briefly to introduce things, I'll take you away from the lovely Brideshead-esque Bullingdon Club, who are incidentally standing on the steps at Christchurch outside two of the history tutors' rooms, which are that one in the right-hand corner and the one above. They still film there and take their photos there every summer, much as we wish they wouldn't. So I will take you to where they are today. And I very much wish I could have been there, wherever this was. I think it might have been somewhere in Bristol. I don't know if anyone went. It looks like quite a fun event. So that's the broader context. It's the funding cuts, the fees of £9,000. Who knows where they'll be in 5 years' time. Budget cuts, harder to find funding, and so on. Again, I'm in a very privileged position here. We will probably not be quite as affected by the cuts as many of the rest of you. We have rich patrons. We own quite a lot of land, a lot of property. We have endowments. We have alumni who are going to give us cash. But I think what we can do is we can use lovely David Cameron's cuts tactics to be a bit of an opportunity to reevaluate our humanities curriculum and our learning and our teaching in history in this changing world. I think in Oxford, maybe we should use it as a prompt to respond and change rather than think, it's all right, we're insulated from what's going on in wider society. So regardless of what you think about cuts and fees, and this young person was not very happy, one good thing, and perhaps the only good thing, is that this can provide a framework for us thinking about what history is really about, what it's for, what it's worth in today's society. And this is something that I do in my own research in an early modern context. I look at the reception of ancient history in the 16th and the 17th century, in the period of Renaissance and Reformation. And what becomes apparent when you start looking into it is that humanists have a very practical idea and of the worth and the utility of history. It's about a Ciceronian idea of history, of using the past to change the present for the better. It's a guide to life. It's showing you how to live a better life. And that strikes me as quite a positive sort of thing that maybe we could take on board and try and encourage in our own students. So I thought I would try and apply this idea of the utility of history to a real-world setting and think about what history does today and what it is that we in Oxford are doing when we teach our history students and why we're doing it. I think, given the things that other people have talked about, there's quite a strong sense among the history community that this is an intrinsically valuable subject, perhaps on grounds of academic rationalism. It is worth our students studying it and therefore paying £9,000 a year. We probably agree that they should carry on doing it. But are we perhaps providing a generic degree which equips students with a set of transferable skills, that lovely phrase, which they can take with them and apply to the future? Or are we training them for a set of professions which have a particular skill set? Perhaps in Oxford that is more the assumption, that there are certain careers our graduates will go on to do, and we tailor the skills to fit in with those civil service, banking, lawyer, consultancy careers. Are we perhaps not engaging too much in Oxford with what students think that they are doing when they're studying history? I think that's quite often the case. This is not something that people question very much in Oxford. We've been here, we've been teaching history for 500 years or whenever history started to become part of the curriculum. But I think we're going to have to in the future. We can't divorce teaching, even here, from the real-world pressures that our students will be facing. So what I'm going to do today is hopefully not talk for too long about some of the research that I've been doing with a colleague. And then I'd quite like your hints, tips, and suggestions, as usual, because most of you know far more about this than I do. And the paper I want to give today grows out of the Postgraduate Diploma in Learning and Teaching in Higher Education, which is, I suppose, the PGCE equivalent for HE that they run here in Oxford at the Learning Institute. I am the only historian out of about 20 people taking the course this year. In fact, I think there's only one other person in a tenuously humanities subject. The rest are all scientists, mainly medics. They are also mainly much more senior than I am, because they have been encouraged by either their career structure or their line managers at the hospital to come along and take part in this course. So what's been happening is we had to do a group investigation, and I was paired, well, small group two, this is Oxford, we don't have large groups here. I was paired with a registrar in clinical medicine, Ben Atwood, who works at the John Radcliffe Hospital. And he was supposed to be here today. He wanted to be here today, but he is at the hospital saving lives or whatever it is that doctors do. So he can't be here. But he has helped prepare and collect some of this evidence. And at the heart of the investigation was a desire to find out a little bit more about what our students think they are doing when they are engaged in learning, and to understand their various approaches to learning so that we can facilitate and enhance their learning in our own teaching. And this, again, as usual, was a fairly qualitative investigation. We used a phenomenographic framework. We wanted to understand the ways that our different and very diverse sets of students experienced and thought about their own learning and the teaching that they were provided with. So what we did is we compared undergraduate historians, my students, with his students who are usually in their final year, clinical medical students. So they've done the boring bit, they're now with the patients, and they are about to become doctors in hospitals in August. They have all now passed their exams, and they will be let loose in a hospital near you in the not-too-distant future. I hope you don't find that too disturbing when you read some of their comments. So since I was working with a scientist, I'm going to frame this a bit like a scientific experiment. So here is how it went. This is our objective, and you can read it for yourselves, to understand what our students think so we can do a bit better, basically. We then had a hypothesis, which is that I think our students are going to do different things when they approach their learning. Why? Well, we thought there are actually very different methods of assessment going on in the two different degrees, and they are taking their degrees for what we imagine to be very different reasons. So we set out to test this hypothesis. We, however, needed some apparatus first. So we had an interview protocol, we had assorted students, time, tea, and biscuits. And that's what it looked like. Again, we revisit Alice from yesterday. So this is my scientific diagram, and I hope my science teachers never get to see it. That is how I believe the interviews took place. But this, more practically, is the method. We invited our students to come and have a chat. Didn't want them to feel obliged, so again, it was a self-selecting group. Didn't want them to feel that it was too pressured or formal. We wanted them to feel free to say critical things if they wanted. So we said it was going to be anonymous. We bribed them with sweets, biscuits, tea. We obtained their consent. And we scheduled in times that were pretty inconvenient to us, but very convenient to them in order to drag them in. So we were, you know, fairly laid back, fairly happy. Some of the interviews took place in the pub, in groups, possibly under the influence of some alcohol, which the students bought for themselves, but it's all right, they're all over 21, no problems there. So that's what we did. There are many problems with this research, as I'm sure you can all spot. We had a very small sample size. We had 15 history students and 7 medical students. That is part of the way that we teach here. 15 was actually quite a lot. All the other groups we had, they interviewed about 3 or 4 students, because that is all that any individual teacher was teaching at that particular time. So we can't really say that any of these observations are reliable or valid, but it's quite a nice little snapshot. There's certainly nothing like the 210 responses from HE professionals that Alan and Jean had. It's nothing like the 100 or however many Wolverhampton or Worcester students that replied, but, you know, that's the best we can do here. And it's certainly also not a particularly objective way of going about things. We had personal hypotheses, and we were probably asking questions in a way that would encourage our students to give us the answers that we wanted, although we tried to let the conversation flow. But there is probably an element of bias in there somewhere. Then there's also the nature of the sample. The students are self-selecting. Because they volunteered or agreed to take part, they're probably going to be those lovely, very keen students who want to help and are maybe slightly more committed or diligent than those who didn't even bother to reply to the email and say, thank you very much, but no thanks. And then, of course, there are a huge number of variables. We don't know how far contextual factors or backgrounds might affect what they're doing, nor how far different skills and personalities that they bring to their degree would also affect what they think. But having said that, we thought, yeah, got to go ahead, got to proceed. So method number two. These were the broad research questions lying behind the interview protocol we constructed. It was based on approaches to learning. A lot of what we've been doing is about deep and surface approaches to learning, and it doesn't matter how much literature you read, that's the way that people still seem to keep talking about things. So that was what was lying behind it. We did focus on assessment. I don't want to talk about that too much today because I think that's a whole different issue. But these were our basic questions, and then we came up with some starter questions as well. So this was sort of how we might think about getting into a discussion with our students. We didn't always ask these questions. We asked related or similar questions, depending on what the students were leading us to say. But it's all about why they're doing it, why they think it's important, what they think is important, and just to get their idea of what they do. We know what happens in a tutorial or a ward round or a class, but we wanted to see what they thought about it. So those are the kinds of questions we ask them. Ultimately, we were trying to gauge motivation for taking the course so that we could then think about how that might affect what we provide if we're going to ask them to pay a lot more money. So next, we come on to the results. I'll start with the historians. I had 15 undergraduate historians in the second or the third year of their degree. 8 of them were male and 7 were female. All of the students were what you might call a typical student. They were under 21. Approximately one third had taken gap years, so they had some experience in between school and HE. All the students but one were native English speakers. The other one was a native Chinese speaker. All but one were of white ethnic background. Roughly half the students had been privately educated, and interestingly, roughly half had received their secondary schooling in countries other than the UK, which, given what Melody was saying earlier, is quite interesting. It was a slightly more varied group than perhaps we might have expected. I would also predict that probably roughly half or slightly over half of these students of mine are going to get first-class degrees, and if they don't get a first-class degree, they will only very narrowly have missed it. So they are highly able students, fairly motivated students. So when we asked them why they wanted to read history, they all said it's because it was interesting. Only one of them had any longer pre-thought-out motivation, like a career path. And this student had always wanted to be a teacher. He said, I've always wanted to be a teacher. At A level, I liked physics and I liked history. I didn't want to be a physics teacher, so I'm reading history. And that was how he rationalised it. But he wanted to teach it to other people. Of the 15 students, only 3 others have even a vague idea at the moment about what they're going to do next. 2 third-year students want to take a master's in history here in Oxford. And 1 second-year student is considering being a journalist. His mother is a journalist. None of the students currently intend to take a law conversion course, which is interesting because a very high proportion of our graduates do go on to take law conversion courses and become solicitors. So this alone suggests that our sample is not what you might call representative of the Oxford historian. But never mind. When questioned, none of the students consciously said they chose to do history because it would develop their transferable skills and make them more employable. This is a reason that if you look at the faculty literature, it cites transferable skills for employability as being quite attractive to potential applicants. Lovely HR speak again, but the faculty thinks that if they say that, students will go, yeah, I want to be employable, I'll go and do history. My students said, no, that's not why I'm doing it. I'll come on to that a little bit later. So when asked how and why they chose certain papers over others, they have a large amount of choice. Why would you pick to study the Crusades rather than, I don't know, women in the 19th century? Majority of students say they choose it because it interests them most. And they say that variety is more stimulating than overlap. One student explicitly said that strategic choosing of papers, so where you might pick lots of papers on the same area to give greater depth of knowledge and therefore make your revision for finals slightly easier, This was something that she actively tried to avoid because she didn't want to limit the interesting things she could learn about. This has caused more work for her. She said she might choose differently in the future because she has been struggling to do a huge range of diverse papers, but she doesn't really regret having learned about all these different things. Only one student had at any point deliberately chosen overlapping papers to make life easier. She thought this would enhance her chances of exam success, and she now very much regrets it because it was a bit boring and she wishes she could have learned more interesting things. So she would choose differently if given the choice. All the students also said that when they picked a paper and it turned out to be less interesting than they had hoped, they spent less time on their work and they didn't bother as much. And the definition of what they called interesting varied from student to student, but at some level it always involved the relationship between the tutor and the atmosphere that happened in that weekly tutorial where they've got one or two or three students with the tutor. That's what essentially made the subject a little bit more interesting, what happens in that 1 hour a week of contact time they get. Now, the students perceive the most important thing they learn in very different ways. Some answers include efficiency, independent learning, time management and writing skills, the ability to get lots of things done in a short space of time, coping with a high workload, those practical skills. And when I asked them why these things were important to them, they all agreed that not only was it good to get through your degree without your tutor being mad at you, but it would be much more useful in later life, partly for careers of any kind, but also one student commented, and the others in the room agreed, this is useful because it makes you a more functional human being. Transferable skills are therefore seen as being important by the students, though this is not a conscious reason that they choose to do history in the first place. And I think there's a distinction that we can make here between the way that some people frame transferable skills as being something for work and for employability, and skills perhaps for life. And yesterday we heard Alan and Jean's respondents complaining about transferable skills just for something you do for work. But my students seem to think about it in a slightly more effective kind of way. It's about life skills, it's about becoming a better person, learning how to cope, not just at work, but you know, someone said, if I have a family and I've got lots of children and I'm still trying to have a job, getting lots of things done at once, being efficient, that's going to be useful. So they think about it in a slightly broader frame rather than just, it'll help me be a lawyer or a banker. Now, the responses describing a class or a tutorial demonstrated the flexibility that we have here that's available to the tutors when they're teaching. The students' experiences ranged through from horrendous, I hate that tutor, terrible, can't cope, I nearly left, to wow, my favourite person on earth, such a great tutorial, I love the subject. Common to all responses then is that idea of the personality of the tutor and the extent, I think, to which the students, they depend very much upon the tutor feeling that they care about student progress. This has a very strong impact on the learning environment. So we've got students here who say, I sort of stopped working for one of my tutors, he didn't seem bothered. And we see that this is probably a mini lecture situation and the student just kind of gives up because there's no point. Also the idea, we had a lot of positive experiences, but the idea that even if there's a bit of friction, a personality clash, or you don't get on with your other person in your tutorial, it's not necessarily negative because it can push you to argue a bit better, frame your ideas in a better way, respond, think a little bit more deeply. Students say they work harder and learn more when they perceive a positive and supportive relationship going on, and they perceive certain teaching styles as a waste of time. So they don't like reading out essays in a tutorial, which is the very old school Oxford way of doing things. They say, that's a waste of half my contact time. Why would I spend half an hour reading out an essay? I'm paying for this teaching. Come on, what's going on? But this seems unrelated to how students think about their degree as a whole more generally. There's the individual tutorial, and then there is the whole university experience. So when probed further, all the students, including the one who was from Australia and not from the EU, and who pays very high international fees, they say they don't think about their teaching and learning as a client or service provider relationship with their tutors. They think that they are almost entirely responsible for making the most of their time at Oxford. It's not to do with what your tutor gives you, it's not to do with what your tutor or your university can provide you with in terms of opportunities, it's up to the student, that's how they see it. Which seems to me to be slightly in conflict with what they're saying about what goes on in a tutorial. So then I asked them about the rise in tuition fees. Most thought that paying more might change the way they think about their degree. Five students said that had higher fees been in place, they would not have chosen to read history because it wasn't useful, not for that much money. Of these five, two would have gone to do law instead. The others weren't sure what they might have done, but they thought PPE, politics, economics, something like that, that might be more attractive to the big businesses that, even though they don't know it yet, they suspect they're going to end up working for. The majority of students felt that even with the higher fees, though, a history degree from Oxford is going to be worth the financial cost because of the reputation of the university and of the degree course itself. So they're paying for the name, they're paying for the brand, and once again, we're very lucky we have that unique selling point that is going to continue to drag people in off the street. But when I asked them about their other choices on their UCAS form, their backup choices, over half the students said they might have reconsidered which universities they had as their backup choice if they were all charging £9,000, which I thought was pretty depressing. And seven students said that they might have evaluated them in terms of price rather than going on university reputation. And then we got into a conversation about what they're going to have to pay back, and they changed their mind. But initially, when they were faced with this, and this was quite new at the time, they thought, I'll probably go for a cheaper one. So, interesting. Several students also complained about the amount of self-directed learning. They say at the moment they feel that it is all about what they do, and that's important, but particularly those from other EU member states said they wish there could be more contact time, either with tutors or with other students. They say independent learning is a bit of a strain, it's a bit of a demotivating factor, and if they had to pay more, they'd want more teaching for their cash, perhaps unsurprisingly. They report very different approaches to preparing for exams, essays and tutorials. Some are much more strategic than others. Some of them consciously employ time-saving strategies when they deal with the weekly reading list, but I can't see any correlation between approach and performance. The students that I think are most naturally most able continue to score highly depending on whether they are very diligent or perhaps less so, whether they are doing more surface learning or whether they are really going into it in great depth. So I don't think there's anything particularly conclusive there. But when I asked them to describe how their course was assessed, they did say, oh, do you mean every week by my tutor, even though it doesn't count towards my degree? Or do you mean by my final exam? So they've got a sense of formative feedback, formative assessment, and summative assessment. So I said, well, which do you think is most important? And they said, the examinations, because that's what goes on my CV. And most of them then made a value judgment about how fairly they thought exam performance evaluated and reflected their effort and their achievement. And there was no consensus between them on whether exams were better than coursework, or vice versa. And individual preferences and confidence about writing under time pressure pretty much determined their answers. And I can't see any correlation with performance there. But they did express dissatisfaction with how Oxford as a whole provides formative feedback and summative feedback. In the case of the formative feedback, because of the variation depending on each particular tutor, some tutors just put a tick and a good at the bottom of the essay, some will discuss it in detail. They don't like summative feedback because they just get a number, and that's all they get. And they get no chance to respond in the next year's exams after their preliminary examinations. And two students in different interviews said that if tuition fees rise, they want staff to give them better feedback, more feedback, and to do it better because they will have a greater stake in their performance. That's the students, which again, perhaps not too unexpected. The picture changes slightly if we look at clinical medicine. So here we've got seven students. We've got them from two different medical schools, the one in Manchester and the medical school here. All of these students are in their final year. And this in itself is significant because they are at the end of a very long course. In the case of those who started here, they're at the end of 6 years. In the case of those on the fast track course, which I think was three or four students, this is the end of 4 years after first completing another three or four year related undergraduate degree course. So by this stage, we can assume that they have developed quite strong strategies for coping with the heavy workload and the time pressure. There's a lot of factual content, and they are quite often assessed every 6 to 8 weeks in the form of an exam or something that they have to write or something that their consultant will sign off. And when asked why they chose medicine, they saw it, all of them, as part of a vocation, and they inevitably saw themselves following a career in medicine after their study. There is a very well-defined career structure, and so motivation is pretty straightforward for learning. You want to pass the exams, you want to be a good doctor, so you can get a job in a hospital and be a doctor. Utterly different picture to the history students. So by the time they are in their final year, they know that's what they want to do. If that's not what they want to do, they will have quit before this point, because it's very arduous, it takes up a lot of time, they don't have much holiday. Interestingly, one of the students we interviewed wasn't taking medicine as his first degree because he didn't feel that when he was 17, he was responsible enough to do medicine. He did natural sciences at Cambridge first, and he said, God, I wouldn't have had me as a medical student when I was 17. I was a nightmare. We said, oh, well, we're sure you weren't. No, but now I'm grown up, and now I think I'll be a really good doctor. But he made that choice based on his evaluation of his personality. So now he feels slightly more mature, and that's what he's going to do this summer. So when we inquired about how they are going to be assessed, variety of assessment methods, written exams, you've got multiple choice exams and short answer exams, OSCEs, which are objective structured clinical evaluations. This is a preset list of tasks and questions relating to a particular subject, which are asked of all students in order to get the idea that they are competent to practice. So there is a formula. And if you learn the correct formula for examining a patient who's got respiratory problems and you pass with full marks, that's great. So you have to introduce yourself properly, you have to have washed your hands, you have to go through a set list of questions, and then you get full marks. So it's fairly prescriptive and formulaic. That's the kind of level we're talking about. And the same goes for the multiple choice and the short answer questions. There is a formula. You learn it off by heart, you put it down, you get full marks. The special study modules are short individual research papers. They're slightly more in-depth. Students can pick exactly what they want to do. And then you are also, a certain proportion of the degree course is made up from the consultant or registrar or whoever signing off your attendance at ward rounds and saying that you have completed the tasks. So a whole mixture of assessment. None of it in the form of write me a dissertation or write me a 3-hour exam paper that is based on essay-style questions. That's not how they do it. So students have different approaches depending on what part of the course they're talking about. They are very tactical learners, and they probably have to be in order to get through the course. So these are some of the things that they say. Unless it's going to be relevant to my future career, I'll just learn what I need to know to pass the exam. And I sort of think about it in two ways. There's the stuff that goes in the exam and the stuff that doesn't go in the exam. That's about being a doctor. And there's a very clear difference in the way they approach the two things. So you can see the second student there is really interested in what it's going to be like being a doctor, spends a lot of time reading around that subject, will go to the hospital on a day off to see what's going on the ward, but when it's the stuff for the exam, learn it off by heart, parrot it off, doesn't really matter. There's also a correlation between the kind of approach that students adopt and what they think their individual medical career path will be. So personal interest and real life or real world motivation provokes a slightly deeper, more considered approach to learning. So if a student wants to be a paediatrician, like our first student here, she's more alert, she can't help it, she wants to read around the subject, she'll go in again for extra ward rounds, she thinks it's great and she loves it. But if she's got to do the physics of MRI, she'll just read the textbook and forget it once the exam is over. The second student can't stand surgery. This is, in fact, our Cambridge Natural Sciences guy we had earlier. He thinks surgery is for engineers. Boring, he doesn't like it. So he just goes along, he'll tag along on the ward round. He's not really interested, he gets signed off. He'll pass the exam, but that's all there is to it. If it's something more medical, involving problem-solving skills, he'll go away, he'll read up on extra cases, and that's the stuff that he remembers now that the exams are over. So there are also these optional modules, the special study modules. People also spend a lot more time working for the special study module because that is their module, it's their paper on what they want to do. Again, they care about that, they read around it, and they're still quite interested in talking to us about it afterwards. So what's the most important thing they learn? They don't really know. It's not about learning anything in particular. I think they make a distinction between knowledge they acquire and the processes that go into making up being a doctor. And the most important thing is that on-the-job learning, being a medical student, being prepared for being a doctor. And all of our 7 students said that being a medical student at clinical medicine is great. They love being in the hospital. That's fantastic. The exams are just a hurdle that they have to jump over, and they don't really enjoy that very much, and they don't think it's very useful. So it's not always easy to categorise how they approach their learning. The course does change as they progress. They'll start in Oxford in a preclinical setting, which is just biochemistry. Then they'll move maybe to the lecture theatre and then to the hospital. They also mature and their attitudes change quite a lot as they go through the course. And as they develop and as they start to be able to cope with the pressures of the course better, they will adopt different learning approaches as they go through. And one student did tell us that it's a popular stereotype of a medical student that we have to learn and regurgitate huge amounts of facts to get through the first years of the course. It's absolutely true, we do, and then we forget it. These people will be in your hospitals sometime soon. Be very afraid. But it appears that they're also able to switch between these surface and the deep approaches when the task requires it of them. So for their final written exams, most of them say most of the time you acquire the facts, you put them down, and you're going to pass. But if you're being assessed for what you're going to be doing in a hospital in a few months' time, you have to have a profound understanding of the processes behind the medical things that are going on. You have to be able to synthesize the facts that you've learned for your exam with an understanding of information that you elicit from patients in a real-time scenario. And they relate all this kind of idea to the tasks they're performing. So they differentiate between being in lectures and reading a textbook, between the practical learning task, which is a more apprenticeship-based role, so shadowing a clinician, taking part in a ward round or a clinic, that requires and stimulates a much deeper approach to learning. And then finally, when I asked them if they would pay higher tuition fees for their course, they said yes, all of them would, without question. They said they thought it was worth the money in order to gain a degree that will give them a stable and safe job, doing something they feel called to do and that they can see being useful to society. They're not in it for the money, but the money isn't bad. but that's not the main point, and they said they'd be happy to pay more. And unlike some of their counterparts in history, they will probably earn enough to have to pay their loan back, which my students might not have to do. So just some conclusions, many, many conclusions from a wealth of interviews. I think we had about 30 hours of interviews in total. No time for that here. But just a few things that in an ideal world I'd like to take away and play around with in my teaching, if I were in a position to do so. And some of you I know have done some of these things I'm going to be talking about, and I'd be interested to hear a bit more about your experiences. So firstly, very basically, the learning environment really matters, particularly in a very personalised setting such as Oxford. We had medical students who said, in the same way that history students do, if my consultant cares about me, I have a great time and I learn a lot. If my consultant can't see why he's got this medical student tagging along behind him, I basically don't go to the hospital because he doesn't care. So quite often you've got them on 2 or 4 week rotations. Consultant says at the beginning, should we just agree that you've been here? And the student says, yeah, that's fine by me. And the student then goes off and stays in bed for about a month. Several students did report this. I don't know any names, so I can't report anybody, but it doesn't sound entirely satisfactory. But if the consultant is engaged, if the history tutor is engaged, the students want to come along and they want to learn more. So they report increased interest, increased stimulation when they feel they are engaging with their tutor, but also with their peers. And this leads to deeper learning. So obviously, the relationship with a tutor is critical. And at Oxford, in the humanities particularly, we are clinging on as hard as we can to our tutorial system that gives us contact with one or two students at a time every week. It's not cost-effective. It is, in fact, very, very expensive. But it is our unique selling point. That is why people apply to us. And medical students and history students say that having this great tutor is the best thing about the tutorial experience. So, given the financial climate and the changes in fees and funding, I wonder if we're moving to a more client-service provider relationship. At the moment, students say that's not how they see it, but some of their responses indicate that they might be starting to think along those lines. And I just wonder what implications this has for us at Oxford as teachers. What is going to happen to the unenthusiastic, unapproachable, uninterested tutors if we enter a phase where the tutorial is seen as a very expensive luxury service for which the students are paying a very large amount of money? Depressingly, I suspect it's not going to make that much difference at the moment because they will be paying £9,000 for one-on-one tutorials and other students will be paying £9,000 for lectures and classes of 40 people. So I think they're probably still going to perceive it as being quite an individually tailored value for money experience. But I'm hoping that maybe it will encourage a focus on teaching slightly more properly or thoroughly among some people who at the moment just think that students are a bit of an inconvenience. So that's my first point and question, and I wonder if anyone maybe who's been through the tutorial system and is now somewhere else has anything that they feel they might like to add, any comments that your students have, so save those for the end. Secondly, Student motivation for choosing a course, as we suspected, can affect the way that they go about learning. The medical students particularly say there is a huge disconnect between the stated aims of the course. If you read the literature, it says we want you to adopt deep learning approaches and synthesize this and evaluate that and create the other. That's not what's going on. They are learning information and spewing it out onto a piece of paper. And there is a big disconnect between that and their personal aim of being a practicing clinician, which they understand as requiring very, very high-level cognitive processes and very complex things and a lot of internalization of material. And as we've seen, when students select optional courses because they are intellectually interested, or they might be more interested in learning how to be a better doctor in this particular scenario, they will adopt mainly deep approaches to learning. When they have to do compulsory, what they call boring options, they don't really bother. And when students are asked to say what they mean by better, I learn better, I work better, they usually said they're using better as a shorthand for more rounded, more generally aware, better equipped to deal with unforeseen challenges. All those flexible, kind of maybe slightly more touchy-feely, skills-based, process-based things that a lot of people have touched on in earlier papers. So history students, when they choose papers, say, I want to study something that's interesting. That is how they select. And these students all mainly take a fairly deep approach to learning. But I think there is a distinction that I can make between the content, which is maybe the area or the topic or the period that the students choose, and that's what they find interesting or not, and the processes by which they learn, maybe what we want to call the skills, the things that they are doing, which is broadly similar no matter what paper they're studying. And that brings us onto the question of what we're actually doing when we're teaching our students history. Does it matter if we're teaching them about the Crusades, or is it more that analysing things, synthesising things? What is it that we want to do or that they perceive that they're doing? And it seems that when the students were talking about the real point of their education and what they found important rather than interesting, it was these skills or the literacies, academic or otherwise, that they were acquiring through the process of their learning. And students in both medicine and history said the most important thing was the vocabulary, the methodology, the practice, the skill, the things they could take with them and apply to other parts of their lives. With the medics, that's the stuff that makes you be a good doctor. And with the historians, it's the difference between the content of the course, which is quite good fun, and then those skills of reading, researching, writing, processing, sorting, coming up with your own ideas that are important and that they're going to take away and do things with later. And they think, they say, they can apply these skills to any kind of job they do, and in terms of organising themselves in later life. And this is very different to the kind of discussion we were having about skills earlier on, just before lunch in this room. So my students can articulate which skills are going to be useful and for what purposes. And I don't know if that's because they've been trained to do so at school in order to get in here or for what other reason. And so what we might call good learning or deep learning or what we want to encourage starts to look a bit like something that students think about in terms of life and being a person rather than passing exams. So it's about what they're interested in and what happens to them when they're interested in something, and when they see how they can take it on and apply it to everything else they do. And given that that's what they see as being important, I think perhaps here in Oxford, to challenge some of the stuff that was said earlier, we need to articulate that a little bit more. It's not at the moment very visible in the curriculum. It's not hidden, but it's perhaps unstated. Perhaps because transferable skills are an ugly kind of thing that we don't want to talk about, but maybe it's a touchy-feely phrase that Oxford won't use. In any case, we don't articulate the fact that that is what we want our students to be doing. They can see they're doing it, but perhaps we need to tell them why it's important that they do it a little bit more. The third thing that I think is important is to realise that my students, at least, think about these things, and they know about these things, and yet we never talk to them about it. It's not something you do. You don't communicate theory about learning and teaching to your students in Oxford. Absolutely horrendous idea. I'm quite keen on transparency, so I do talk to my students, and in fact I did at the end of these interviews. And I showed them this revised Bloom's taxonomy of cognitive processes, and I sort of described it in terms of the verbs that are being used. And interestingly, they could point to the different levels to talk about what they're doing at different parts of their courses. So the history students point to the same level for their weekly exam, their essay, or their weekly essay, their exam, and what they think that professional historians like me are doing in our work. if it's a paper they find interesting. So for something they find interesting, they put themselves at the top. They say, well, I'm rewriting the history of Elizabeth's, you know, foreign policy. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing that stuff at the bottom, and then I'm creating something new to give to you because that's what you want, or because that's what I find interesting. Medical students point to very different levels. If they are interested in something, like a special study module, they're doing things at the top of the pyramid. If it's an exam and they're not interested, they're just remembering things. They can possibly explain it, but that's all that they can do. And history students, when they're doing papers that they don't find as interesting as they anticipate, also say they don't usually hit the top level of the pyramid. They still have to do things like applying, analysing and evaluating, but they won't bother to put their own ideas into it and create something new in terms of history. They will just synthesise other people's ideas and put them in the right order in an essay. So just finally, cuts for all of us mean cutbacks. And in a very huge and diverse history faculty like we have here in Oxford, at the moment we have quite literally hundreds of people teaching undergraduates. We've got the teachers, the time and the resources to give this huge range of courses. And within each course, a student can choose pretty much what they want to do. So it's like an eat all you like buffet. You can pick and choose your course, you can make it up. You might have to have a little bit of salad, but essentially, if you don't want much of it, you don't have to have it. And if you want to eat absolutely everything, you can, and lots of students do. And they find that really interesting. But if we have cutbacks, even here in Oxford, it might happen, you never know. This could mean that there is less choice. We have less money to pay people to research these diverse topics. So this could mean we have fewer people to teach the students these topics, so they'll have less choice. They won't therefore own their degree in quite the same way they do at the moment. So will they be less interested? Medical students certainly say if they're not so interested, they don't work so well. Is that perhaps what might happen to our history students if we try and limit their choice too much? So I think perhaps here in Oxford we're going to have to spend more time thinking about working out how to keep our students interested if we do have to limit their choices slightly for financial reasons. They are the consumer, so we've got to give them a reason to buy in. At the moment we seem to think they're just lucky to be here and lucky to have us, and that might well be true, but we're also quite lucky to have them, and I think we need to try and work out how we're going to keep them on side when the going gets even tougher. And I just wonder if the medical degree might offer us a way to do this. And also some of the things that people were talking about in terms of work-based learning. Apprenticeship, vocation. These are words that yesterday were treated with a little bit of scepticism or caution. And we don't want to make everyone be a historian for the rest of their lives. We don't want them all being archivists or librarians. But perhaps there is something in that sense of vocation in the medical degree course leading to engagement with learning and a willingness to get through the tough bits because the end result is worth it that can perhaps give us some interesting ideas for what we do in history. And just thinking about the great ideas that I've heard from some people in the room about what you do in terms of connecting your history students' learning with the world of work or the real world, is there anything you can suggest that in my context here, where I'm very limited, the institution will not support me in creating radical new modules, is there anything I can take away, however small, and apply to my own teaching to make my students a little bit more committed to history if things get tougher for us here in Oxford? That's it. Thank you very much.